So I think that in today's session we are going to have four short presentations, and all related to membranes, but I guess different aspects. My part of the story is I'm interested in how to think about membranes in vivo, in particular in the context of cell motility. This by itself was a huge topic. So what I'll do, I'll just briefly sort of motivate the problems that are there, and then I'll actually go a little bit over a review from Michael Sheets on membrane regulation in vivo and basically membrane homeostasis and how to think about membrane, how membrane tension is regulated and so on, and that's my plan. So here you see a growth cone that has motile aspects, and this already shows you that the membrane is very active, and both in front where you form filopodia, and also here in this section you have ruffles and so on, so also processes. So clearly the dynamics of the cytoskeleton is coupled to the membrane dynamics, and it's fairly complicated. I already showed this picture once that the cytoskeletal part by itself is regulated in a complicated way. And then on the membrane part, there are forces that act between the membrane and the cytoskeleton. There are adhesions. So in principle, there are dynamic adhesions that, as we'll see in a few minutes, the apparent membrane tension largely actually comes from transient attachments of the membrane to the cytoskeleton. And also there are, I'm not going to talk about it today much, but there are also proteins that induce curvature. And those proteins also can, in many ways, regulate membrane dynamics. In our own model of lamellipodial protrusion, last time I was more talking about the cytoskeletal part, but we do have, so if you think of a lamellipodium as being 200 nanometer high and a several square micron in width, then we sort of assume that so this is 200 nanometer high, that this part that just goes over the square micron, it's just a flat membrane, and only the edge of a lamellipodium, that's where you get, let me see if I have it here. So we sort of assume that this part is flat and it's not interesting, and sort of what's interesting is this edge part of the membrane. And obviously, maybe it's a reasonable zero-third approximation, but there are also a question of what's happening in this vertical direction, and there are ruffles and things like that. And in terms of this edge section, let me go to this. So we describe it as a Helfrich Hamiltonian. So we have a bending energy term, a surface term, and there is that third term that maybe is not that common in a sense. And that term is, you can think of it as gravitational energy. So it basically says that as the edge of the membrane, as the edge of the membrane, it just goes up in this y direction, then its potential energy goes up and up. And what it means, so it's different from normal surface tension in this lateral direction, where it says that it wants to be more flat than curved. And then this again comes from this picture, is that if you are looking at this line, and you sort of think about this line going forward, even if this line is straight, by going forward, it increases the membrane area. So this is this implicit assumption that we are not modeling this flat section of the membrane, but that flat section has an important feature, that it pulls back this whole line. So the cytoskeleton has to work against that. So that basically creates a constant force that gets incorporated into this term.
Derek, at the edge, vertically speaking, or I don't know if that thing is vertical or it has an angle, what's the dimension there?
It's also around 200 nanometers, I think. I mean, I'm not.
So it's very thin, isn't it?
Yeah, the whole thing. I mean, the whole thing is, the whole lamellar podium is multiple square microns in width, but it's only 200 nanometers in thickness or in height.
So at the tip, the membrane must be rather strongly curved, as a matter of fact.
Exactly. So
depending on the tension, we might even be dominated by elasticity of the membrane, not really by tension.
Right. And all these things basically get renormalized and incorporated into these parameters. That even if it's curved like a rolled, that basically you can still think of it as a line, but now it has new elastic parameter and a new surface tension.
You're saying is there may be non-local interactions because of the
non-local
meaning the
along the line. I mean along that curved. I mean thinking about this as a flat membrane to which you will make a perturbation probably doesn't work very well.
Right, and that's not actually
curvature is so important.
And that's not how we think. We think of the edge as basically if you take a cylinder and you cut half of the cylinder, then you get sort of this rim that's sort of curved. And now you can approximate or can think of it that you have a line. And so that cylinder, so if I take just a cylindrical tube and I start bending it and so on, I'm going to have something like this.
Is the first term describing the undulation of a cylinder or a flat plane?
No, of a cylinder. So everything, I mean, that's why I think maybe wasn't, I went maybe a little bit too fast, is that everything is about basically this. I mean, I drew it like this, and the representation is really one-dimensional, but you have to think of this as actually being little curved. So it's like a half a cylinder that's being sort of, so for half a cylinder, then you can write this Hamiltonian, and you are completely missing this big member.
Where in this your cylinder bending one way or the other is actually symmetric? So there's a spontaneous something in your, I don't see in your first terms.
No, in this case, cylinder cannot bend the other way because this whole thing is on the surface. Right? It's a.
Which surface are you talking about?
The whole lamellar podium is on the surface. Like, I can show it to you.
The cylinder I'm talking about bending along the surface. This is on the surface, and it can bend one way or the other.
So let me try to draw a cylinder, which I guess is not. So this is my cylinder. And then actually, this is sort of connected to this lamellar podium. And this whole thing is on a surface, attached to a surface, right?
Uh-huh.
So a cylinder can bend this way, but it cannot bend out of plane.
How do you describe H there, Garrick? Where is H?
H here, let me go to. So I think actually I had a. So I think y direction is this, and then we have x and z. So and the Hamiltonian is h of y basically. so I'm describing this line.
H of
X,
I would say.
It should be H of, why is it written? Probably H of X.
H of X. Or just change the code.
Yeah, anyway, probably it's not consistent. But yeah.
I think the basic question
basically
is
it's the
whether you describe the cylinder as an effective field.
And this is the cell body, basically.
Yeah, Garrick, I think that the question is either if this kind of energy is describing the cylinder as an effective filament, or if it's actually a description of the deformations of the membrane itself.
It's an approximation where we try to describe the deformation of the membrane itself here by just having basically a line to describe this deformation and try to, I mean, I guess the most complete way to do it is to have the full 2D representation of the membrane, including here, and then this curved part. And
for half a cylinder, you just write 1 over R1 is, let's say, 1 over the radius of the cylinder. 1 over R2 is what you present as minus the second derivative along the line.
Mm-hmm.
Then you square it. Then you get your term plus a linear term, which will vanish at the boundaries because integration of 1
well,
over
we
R.
Well, we have periodic boundary conditions.
Yeah, so it will vanish.
Yeah.
Just a constant. I mean, it's 2 pi something. And yeah. That's it. So you get it.
Yeah, and
the constant.
But that's what you had in case.
So it's okay. You just forgot, you just omitted the constant, that's all. And there was one, actually two constants.
Yeah, and we need forces from this, so we differentiate it. So basically, this constant.
So you simply assume the curvature here is much.
Yeah, it's the, like the munch representation.
There's not contains curvature and so on.
And the new thing in a sense is this part, because we have implicit. We didn't really take into account this part of the membrane that was stretched, right? Or because the lamellipodium is growing, and as you make bigger and bigger lamellipodium, in a sense, the surface tension here, the area here. Wants to pull the thing back. So by adding that height potential, we take that into account in a sort of simple way.
Okay, can I just make a drawing on why I raised this question? Is because before I was imagining that you have a flat membrane, and if you have a flat membrane, and then you came with one of your spikes and push on it, you are going to deform it over some distance, but then the characteristic deformation lengths here depends whether it's or not dominated by tension and so on. And the fact that you have a curvature radius on the other direction, which is small, and then any case comparable to the square root of what you call kappa b divided by gamma, means that maybe this is the question of the interaction. So in something like this, if you create deformations which are farther apart than this deformation of the membrane itself, then these things are not going to interact laterally, right?
If they are, yeah.
But this interaction probably is longer range if the membrane is also curved that way. This is the reason.
It's not longer. It will cut actually. It will be one dimension. If there is interaction, it's one dimensional problem, not two dimensional.
Yeah, I mean, this Hamiltonian, and actually that's what we get, is that we have filaments here that are pushing, and they do interact, and they do interact through this Hamiltonian already. So, yeah, saying that because of the cylinder nature here, that there's like some additional term?
The range of over which the interactions play, I think it will depend on that curvature.
Right, but that's what I was trying to say. It will just renormalize these gammas. Yeah, I didn't say what it is, right? I mean.
Yeah, KB is actually as the radius of the.
Yeah, the radius of the curvature will.
Yeah, of course.
So I mean, maybe I should put tildes to make sure that, yeah, these are not the bare parameters for the membrane. Yeah. And in the case of actually interaction with filaments, in our case, we just put steric repulsion. There's no really physical reason for the functional form. It's just that we wanted to have a characteristic distance for steric repulsion. But in our model right now, we don't have attraction, but it's known that many filaments, they tether to the surface, and so there are also attractive adhesive interactions of cytoskeleton to the surface, and I'll tell you about that in a second. So this was, I think I showed this movie that if you run the simulation, if you want, you can now concentrate on the membrane and see that it can deform quite a bit, although it's still sort of.
So this is different from the picture of ordered polymerization, right? So.
Actually, if you project, it is directional.
No, it doesn't look very.
It's not completely isotropic, let me say it that way, because the ARP23, which is the branching species, it creates a 70-degree angle. We actually allow some fluctuation of this angle, but it's not a large fluctuation. So first of all, you have branching at nearly 70 degrees, at least that's the dogma in the field, which some people and the second thing is that growing this ARP, the branching activity, occurs only near the membrane. And the reason for it is that there are proteins associated with the membrane that basically turn on branching. So basically, pretty close to the membrane, you get new branching. And because of that, it turns out that just these two things are enough in this geometry to spontaneously orient all the filaments with certain angle to the membrane. That if you sort of look at the distribution of angles, you actually get something like 35 degrees on average. So in that sense, it's not completely isotropic, although it looks isotropic. It has a certain polarity of growing ends orienting themselves toward the membrane. Now, this was the first part, just to sort of show why I was interested in general. I'm interested in the in vivo membrane questions and so on. I haven't done more extensive membrane modeling in terms of cytoskeletal dynamics, except for what I showed. But we want to get into it in a sense and have more realistic picture in multiple regards of how to treat the membrane. So I thought I'll show three, four slides now of a review by Michael Sheets, where based on his and other people's experiments, they sort of talk about membrane homeostasis and how tension is regulated and so on. And most of it is just I took some lines from that review. I just thought that some of the empirical facts are quite interesting. So one, as usual, I mean, it's like with biology textbooks. There are these statements that are authoritative and interesting. I think so regardless whether they are ultimately correct, I think it's good to know them, and then later you can question them and so on. I think this is a 2006 review. So I don't know if in the last 2006 or... 2006. So I don't know if in the last 5 years any sort of these things have changed a lot. The first thing is that the statement is that in animal cells, the amount of the membrane that the cell has is much larger than the volume that it has. I don't know. But at least it's not a 5 to 10%, but it's much bigger than that. I don't know what exactly. Maybe someone else knows. I don't know, huh?
Compared to a sphere, you mean?
Yeah, like if you look at a cell as a volumetric object and say, how much membrane do I need to envelope that volume, the membrane that the cell has is much bigger. I don't know what that much means, but it's much bigger.
There are two factors. One is just because it's not spherical, which is a trivial term. And the second is because a lot of extra pockets, which is kind of non-trivial, but that's it.
Right. So for example, I know one example. I think Neil Gove talked about it, that in the case of red blood cells, or no, lymphocytes, I think, they have these microspikes where you have lots of membrane stored, basically. And the reason for this is that when these cells go into narrow capillaries, they have to deform into very long cylinders to go through because the capillaries are much narrower than the cells themselves. And this then you can think of it as a membrane storage, basically, that can be used to make a long cell when you need. In addition to that, you also have lots of internal membrane, and this probably is even bigger storage. I don't know if it's already there, but you basically have active trafficking mechanism between the internal membranes and the external membranes. So that's this endo and exocytosis mechanisms. That's another way how you can bring in a membrane as it needs.
Internal membranes, you mean membranes of the organelles?
No, even the cytoplasmic
reticulum
and so on. I think there is a lot of, I don't actually know. There are vacuoles, and I think there is lots of internal membrane.
But that's a factor of 10 or more?
Again, I don't know. We have to check. I mean, I don't know if, first of all, I don't know if it's cell-specific, like if, like to what degree it's, like if there is a good answer or not to that. But what's interesting is that that I think the sort of the second line is that in 1 hour, the whole plasma membrane on the surface of the cell gets replaced through this endoexocytosis mechanism. So I think it's one of these things that when you read, it's amusing that I think you replace all your molecules in your body like within a month or something, which is amusing. So I think that's what biological systems are. They are not really, in that regard, static. They just dynamically remodel themselves all the time.
Well, it gives you an answer because they're saying it produces 360 microns square, and the typical area of the membrane is probably like 10 microns square. So you're getting a huge factor.
Okay. So So yeah, so and here it's sort of saying that, I mean, one question is, for example, when we make this lamellapodia, what happens with surface tension? For example, if you have a finite surface material, then as you start to project, for example, this lamellapodia, your surface tension will go up, right? Because you'll quickly limit the non-extensible limits. But here it sort of says that the extension rate can be comparable in some cases, I guess if it's at least not very fast, with the endoexocytosis rate. So as you extend, you can bring in surface material with you. So in that regard, it's like you have a chemical potential stat that can provide you with lipids as you need. You just have to pay the energetic price. So they can do, in terms of the experiments, they can do lysis experiments. And I'll talk in a second about the pressure, osmotic pressure differences between the inside of the cell and the outside. But basically, in biological membranes, if you do not have this extra storage, then as usual, you just need a few percent of the extension of the membrane. And then after that, you'll start to break the membrane. So one of the experiments that Michael Sheets has done a lot is to attach a bead to the cell surface and pull a tether. And that can be used actually by holding it with an optical tweezer. You can measure the force and so on, which I think is on the order of a few piconewtons, around maybe 10 piconewtons. And this statement says that as you pull long, I mean, as you keep pulling the tether, you don't seem to see the membrane tension changing. So again, telling you that there are enough internal things like this or.
How fast the tether is pulled?
I think they can pull fairly. I don't know what the numbers are, but probably fairly fast. And also, there's an interesting statement too, is that if you pull tethers from different sides of the cell, it seems that they are coming from the serum reservoir. And I guess this statement is related to your question, is that if so there is a kinetic component that if you pull,
huh? Is it millinewton or micronewton?
I think it's supposed to be millinewton.
It's
I found some misprints. I don't know if it's actually.
No, it's millinewtons, but it's a little bit less than that. It's typically more like, you know, 2 or 3, but it's right order of magnitude.
But also remember that in cells, half of the membrane is actually proteins, right? I mean, or maybe third, I don't know. But the amount of those components is really non-trivial. It's not a small sort of diluted membrane solution, but it's like. You really have to think of it more like a lipid protein.
Lysis in a true cell does not need to be the same values as for a.
Exactly. And also, you have cholesterol, and I mean, so the cell membranes are very complicated in their composition.
What changes a lot is also if it's coupled to something internally.
Exactly, and it is.
We have made vesicles with gels inside, and they are attached to the gels. And you can apply pressures to deform these things, which are, I don't know, 10, 100, sometimes 1,000 times larger than ones that you apply for vesicles, and they don't rupture.
Mm-hmm.
So having the membrane attached to some internal structure, that changes a lot with a micropipette.
What's the pressure?
Well, sucking, yes.
Uh-huh. And so one mechanism that we talked about it a little bit, there are these things called, and I guess there are multiple mechanisms for membrane storage and regulation. One of them is this vacuole-like dilations, and you can see that and that's another interesting thing to think about, is that you have an internal surface, an internal pressure in the cell, and then you have the external pressure. By changing the tonicity of the outside solution, you can be hypertonic, isotonic, or hypotonic, so you can actually go to negative pressures easily if you want. And by doing that, you either swell the cell, or you can actually shrink it, so it gets sort of when you shrink the cell, then all this extra surface area creates this thing called vacuole-like dimensions. And in some cases, these things are transient for several minutes. They are there, and they can be obviously used again for swelling again because they are like membrane storage. I think in some cases they can be much more long-term. So again, this kind of invaginations of a membrane, you can think of it as an entropic sort of, in terms of, again, surface tension-like ideas, it's like now this is the easy part to push out because you just sort of wringle out the invaginations. And then after that, and then only after that you get maybe to the next step. So from the viewpoint of a membrane, you probably have multiple surface tensions as you do these processes, depending in which regime you are, whether you, for example, have these kind of things or these invaginations, or whether you are more or less like in a swollen regime, and you're already starting to use the endocytosis mechanism and so on. So
the pressure couples to volume when the membrane is coupled to area. So how you're doing hypertonic?
So in the case,
you'll just try to change the volume.
Right.
You're saying that is not enough. I mean, that's so. It's how much?
Yeah, the volume of the cell changes.
How much? Is it like factor of two?
Again, I don't know the numbers, but I think, does anyone know?
With the cells, I don't know, but with vesicles, you change the volume by a very little factor,
yeah.
Well, what happens is that when you do that, if you put a vesicle in the same conditions, you also generate, if you increase, for instance, the pressure outside, the vesicle is going to try to reduce the volume, and it has too much surface. The surface is incompressible, and it needs to pull out, in or out, sometimes in, sometimes out, sometimes both, these little things, you know, either strings or little pearls, or you can extract lots of the membrane from the main body of the.
My impression was that with cells, maybe you can do. The volume change can be larger, but again, I don't know how much larger. I think I can look it up.
It depends how fast you adapt for the volume changes, of course. In the vesicle, that's controlled really by membrane permeability. Here, if there are pores and so on, you probably can adjust at a different rate.
But you need to change, I mean, if you want to change the volume of a cell for a lot, you basically can pump mostly water and salt inside and outside, so you change the concentration of proteins and everything, which is not very favorable. You don't want to go from 60% solid to 30%, that's going to change properties tremendously.
Yeah, I don't know the numbers for cells, yeah, but I'd be surprised if it's a factor two. It's probably, you know, 10%.
I'll check it. I'll see if there are estimates. Huh?
I think it's more than 10%.
And the last topic I want to talk about, I have two more slides, is about blebbing, which is an interesting phenomenon, which I think I have a picture on the next slide. But basically, if you have a cell, I don't know if you guys can see. If you have a cell, it can form things like this. So these are called blebs. Actually, many cells die that way, that if you kill a cell in the final agony of dying, what they do, they form lots of blebs, and then that's how they die. So I think for a long time, blebbing, it wasn't, I don't know, like what was the, I'm not sure if it was thought that how important is blebbing, but I think there's some evidence that in when you do two-dimensional cell motility, I already showed you some both movies and the picture on the simulation side, it's thought that maybe in 3D, actually, blebbing-like activity could be more important in terms of cell motility even. So in general, it's an interesting topic. And here, in the case of blebbing, the main, sort of one of the main ideas is that you have a cytoskeleton here. And basically, cytoskeleton, there are adhesions of cytoskeleton to the membrane. And you have an internal pressure in a cell typically is higher than outside, a little bit higher. So these cytoskeletal attachments are needed to prevent it from blebbing. And then people can do experiments where you try to cut these attachments and see what's happening and so on. Okay. And typically, so you can try to create gaps here and see when do you form a blob. And basically, these are kind of experiments that I think we talked about before. Is that
just like an instability cycle? Huh? It's like sort of instability.
Yeah, you can actually see it from here. Is that you can basically, so if this is your membrane or the line. This is the cortex, the cytoskeleton. This is your membrane, and at some so here you have attachments, and at some point, let's say you start to form a blob. So in a blob, there is no cytoskeleton. So the basically membrane escapes the cytoskeleton, and you can, if you want, you can apply an explicit suction pressure to get yourself some pressure differential. Now, in terms of the sort of how to think about this energetically, the surface tension of the membrane is actually sum of two terms, sort of some sort of internal surface tension, but also the attachments of the membrane to the cytoskeleton, the adhesive energy. As you form an area, you lose those attachments. So you also pick up another term coming from these attachments, and that I think is actually a bigger term, or significantly bigger term. So the apparent surface tension that you measure is mainly coming probably from the interaction of the membrane with the cytoskeleton. And then you can think of some sort of simple picture like this, is that the volume term is favorable with increasing pressure. So you want to form a bubble basically there because the internal pressure is higher. And that's opposed by increasing the membrane area that has two components, this apparent surface tension that has the adhesive part to the cytoskeleton, and also you have the bending modulus of the membrane, and then you can sort of analyze this to see when do you get an instability. So I actually haven't done this analysis. I mean, it should be a trivial thing to do, but I haven't done it to sort of check what the numerical results are. But basically, the idea is that for typical surface tensions that they have, or they think they have, and so on. And I think this is wrong. This is maybe this P. The pressure differential and so on. That the critical hole radius is on the order of a micron. That if you cut your cytoskeleton, so this A is the if this A, you cut it on the order of a micron or maybe a few hundred nanometers, then the internal pressure of the cell could push a blob out. And usually I think I've seen many experiments where what could happen is that, so this blob starts to grow, but then actually cytoskeleton can move in. And so the cytoskeleton can grow and fill basically the blob, reconnect to the membrane and pull it back. So these are kind of processes that you get. So that's what I wanted to talk about, the in vivo membrane issues, and probably this is a small fraction of what was interesting.
Okay, thank you. Just a comment on this. This looks really like a problem that we kind of tackled but didn't solve it exactly yet. It's a very simple problem. It's related to something that has been tackled already. So people have been interested in adhesion. So a problem that is known now that has been solved exactly by Fourier and so on is this: a vesicle that is attached to a substrate with some attachment energy omega, and that has some kappa and some gamma, with of course an internal pressure which is in excess of the external pressure. So this is not the problem that you are talking about. Is very similar to this one, except that the membrane should be seen as that, but rather as
going outside there.
Going outside, yeah, still with an adhesion energy, with an excess pressure, and so on. And this has not been solved yet.
difference is that you, when you talk about surface tension, you're talking, it's like a quench attachment. When in membrane, you have points can float.
You have the two possibilities, right? Either you have an infinite reservoir.
Well, infinite, but you can rearrange.
Or impose a tension.
The rafts can float out.
So this is probably related.
Although
substrate is not a nice substrate and so on, but if you can describe that some effective attachment energy, then this is.
Yeah, and I think in 3D, if it's true that blebbing might be somehow used in cell motility, I think then we have to better understand how this internal pressure plays a role.
We have been interested in this, of course, because in our case, what we have is that's the source of pressure.
But then, if you have a substrate, there should be another term, because also the area when we are going to block is connected to the surface, of the surface substrate.
That's true, but that's in omega. So, I mean, in here what happens is that, as Garrick was saying, if you detach it, the energy that used to get to be in contact with the substrate, you're going to lose it, and of course that's proportional to the area that you open.
Carlos, if you convert that 20 millinewtons per meter into the size of a polymer,
I don't understand that P, because it should be a pressure.
Yeah, I think the right. I think it's. I mean, I think if this P is correct.
That's surface tension. Usually.
Yeah, I think it's incorrect. This number. At least if you take their sigma and this critical value of one and back calculate P, that should be 20 Pascal.
20 Pascal.
Yeah, which is quite small.
Very small indeed.
So it's a huge polymer. It's very, very soft. Because for polymers, the pressure is much higher.
I have to go and check this calculation.
I'm not suggesting that the cortex detachment is induced by polymers.
No, I'm saying that.
Just in the case where you have a polymer, then. The scales are smaller. For a polymer, even for the HDNA as the ones we work with, these scales are going to be smaller than that. But our energy is
what's smaller? You said the pressures? What's smaller?
The detachment size.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh. Pressures, with a polymer, if you confine it a lot, you can get very high pressures as well, of course. Okay, I don't know. Mark, would you like to?
Okay, so I'm going to talk actually about some experiments which I'm not involved with, but they keep asking me to explain things, so I'm going to pass it on. And in fact, I think there should be some stuff that can be done analytically. It's too big actually to do in terms of simulation. So these are people who are at Sandia Livermore site, and Daryl Sasaki. He does some lipid chemistry. So in fact, this DSIDA lipid is a lipid that he has created, changing the head group. Got to go through this. And what they do is they get this tubule formation solely due to just putting protein binding to the vesicles. So they make this mixed lipid GUVs, and this is just showing the different components. So the red is a liquid phase lipid. It could be POPC, but the one that has the biggest effect is this phytonol phospholipid, and the difference with the pycnol, it has these methyl groups on it. And so it can have negative curvature. Phytonol is one of the lipids that people have studied in membrane fusion, so they can go to the curved regions. And then the other component is in the gel phase, and that's this modified lipid. And the head group is modified. It's an amino diacetic acid. But what it does is it can bind copper 2+. Now, the electrostatics in this case is not particularly important. What's important in this particular case is it can also bind histidine-tagged proteins. So that's what they actually do, is that they tag proteins with histidine, and then they can bind to the lipids in this gel phase.
And how would you define this gel phase? What's the difference between gel and liquid?
Okay. Well, so in the gel phase, it's going to be, and I have actually some questions for them. It's a standard lipid gel phase where it's pretty dense, so the area per lipid is going to be in the 40-something angstrom squared. It's really not that much of a diffusive phase. This, though, because these are coexisting phases.
So if I pack, let's say, individual lipids there, mm-hmm. and I monitor their motion, they will be stay one place. That's the general idea.
Yeah, I mean, you get, yeah.
Diffusion coefficients in the gel phases are a factor 30 to 100 smaller than in the liquid phase. In the liquid phase is about 1 square micrometer per second.
Yeah.
So we are talking about something that is roughly 100 times smaller.
Does it have a finite zero shape module? So it's 0.0?
Yes, yes. If you make a vessel like this in the gel phase, and then you apply an osmotic pressure difference, for instance, you end up with ping pong balls crushed. You know, they can break and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a little bit surprised that this is still curved, because my experience.
If you do it carefully, you can have your nice ping pong ball, which is not curved. So, you know, it's like a piece of.
Yeah, when you do simulations with the gel phase, they're really stiff, but that's over a much smaller area.
I had a comment about the Diffie-Tendo wheel, which might interest other people here. If you look at, so any lipid, you can see the temperature of the main transition, which is the transition at which, you know, it goes from the liquid to the gel phase. And you know, you take this in POPC, is perhaps, I don't know, 5 degrees or something. You take DOPC, it's minus 22. You take DPPC, it's 42. So this temperature ranges, which we can understand. This Diffie-Tendo wheel not only has perhaps this curvature-inducing effects, but if you look at the temperature at which this is supposed to become a gel phase, it's minus 100 or minus 100. I mean, it's ridiculously small temperature. So this thing's never going to the gel phase for some reason.
Right.
Well, and I don't think this is
really.
They are chemically different.
Well, it doesn't pack. So, I mean, that's the other difference is. So the POPC has a double bond, which is kind of a kink in the tail, and it doesn't pack well, so that makes it liquid. These bumps on the methyl groups on the tail mean it doesn't pack well, so it's very liquid. These actually are fully saturated, so they pack well, and that's what the gel phase is. It's
so
like
it's crystalline packing of the alkene.
I think of it more as a glassy packing, but. So it's not fully crystalline, but it's dense.
It's a liquid crystal. It's not.
This is liquid. The liquid is also liquid crystalline. This is
a liquid crystal, then it will not behave as a gel.
Yeah. So that's it's dense. And then the protein that they mainly use is the green fluorescence protein, which of course you can see here. And the basic effect is that you bind a lot of the green fluorescence protein, and it will then start to deform the membrane, and you can get these all kinds of tubules growing off.
Which one has negative temperature?
So it's actually the red one, the liquid, not the gel. So it's the red one.
So this, you,
it has, you know, under, in certain parts of the phase diagram.
Not in this condition.
So under these conditions, no.
So proteins insert themselves into the membrane, into the gel, or just to interact with it?
They're binding to the head group.
Just to the head?
Yeah. So you've got a deformation of the membrane by actually a collection of proteins that are not intrinsically curvature-inducing proteins. So there are a whole set of proteins like the BART domain that, you know, their purpose is to bend the membrane. This is just really, you know, protein crowding, and a large number of proteins doing that. And these tubules will form.
But here, how do you go from G to F?
How you go from, sorry?
G to F. Because somehow it looks like you start with two domains and you end up with.
I think these are just some pictures
from different
times. Yeah.
But they're different, same object, or they're just different objects?
I don't really know. I don't think it actually says in the caption. The difference here is that with this liquid phase, the platinol lipid, you get almost a half of a tubule per vesicle, whereas in the POPC, you really get only 1/50th of the vesicles give you the tubule. So for whatever reason, this lipid plays kind of a bigger role. And part of that is that, you know, while this looks green, it's a mixed coexistence. So they're in here and they're playing some role in that coexisting phase.
So that's kind of one of the puzzles.
And then this is some of the data. So this is the tubule length. This is up to 20 microns. This is the vesicle radius, up to 5 or 6 microns, and the different colors are the different amounts of the gel lipid. So basically what's going on is that the gel domain area is conserved in the tubule form, so that the area of the tubule is equal to the area of the gel domain, and this is just as you add more, you get longer tubules.
But the radius of the tubule is doesn't matter.
So that's kind of one of the questions: is what's the preferred radius?
So what are you fixing?
So they don't actually have the plot of the radius; they have the length. And the radius does well. The ratio of the radius with the tubule length they find is constant.
Which is strange.
Yeah. And just a ballpark number, you know, these are 50 nanometer, so it's in this kind of magnitude. But, you know, you've got, of course, curvature effects going on, and given the data, I think, you know, should be some simple relations.
It's not linear, going from green to red to blue.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it to me. And, well,
so what happens with the
it's 7.5 to 10% to 15%.
It's a huge change.
Yeah, so there's something.
So what happens when the rest of the material gets dissolved in the vesicle?
No, I think, though, that that's just the slope related to the vesicle radius itself.
Does the GFP both in and outside, or on the outside?
So, their mixed coexistence, presumably there's both lipid types in both domains.
No, I mean the GFP.
Oh, the GFP. It's only on the outside of the, in this case, outside of the vesicle. I think they've done some stuff with varying. We're not going to go into that. So, you know, here's their kind of schematic. And there's a bunch of different questions. So, first of all, of course, kind of what's the driving force for the tubule? And basically, the binding of all of these proteins to the domain, and of course, having the domain is kind of a key part. If it were dispersed overall, either you'd have to completely cover the vesicle, which is kind of an uninteresting case, or your concentration is too low against the test, and then it doesn't form.
Well, you see, tubular without a vesicle down the end, because put from the picture, whenever you have a tubular, there's a separate vesicle appearing in the opposite.
Not always.
No, sir. That,
and I don't know if they've investigated in terms of under what conditions that happened. In fact, earlier work where they were using streptavidin and biotinylated lipids, and you just had a whole system, they were looking at collisions between vesicles, and as they kept moving, you get tubules. And I don't know whether that all similar sort of thing could be actually happening.
Well, or if you have
a Hess tag on the GMP more than one, and it could actually bind to vesicles at some point, and then they just collide and merge.
Well, if you said if there's some mixed phase, you can have locally microphase separation creates a little bubble.
Well, that would be the other thing. I mean, in one sense, forming a single domain, it means you've kind of done pretty well in terms of the equilibrate structures. There's no reason why you couldn't have multiple domains. In fact, normally when I see pictures of that, that's usually what you have.
Well, not, I wasn't talking about volume, I'm talking about the islands of one phase and another phase,
right.
But that's the only way you could have the double.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you can.
It's not
curvishing. Right.
Does the GFP stay long married? I mean, it tends to aggregate when it's very high concentrations?
Well, that's kind of, what's the role of the protein-protein interaction? And the presumption is no. They've done other proteins as well. They've done M orange, which I'm not sure of, but I presume it's orange fluorescent protein. And they have also done TLR4, which is an immune response protein because that's the other area of work, and you have some monstrous protein. So they've done a few different proteins, and basically it's just binding to the surface, being dense enough, and kind of the question is how dense do you actually have to be?
But so the simple calculations of the ratio of head to tail doesn't explain this?
No such calculations.
This is protein induced, right?
Right. So you attach something to the head, it becomes bigger,
yeah.
You go to different...
I'm sure
that's sort of the...
I think that definitely plays a big part of the role.
But did it check if it doesn't work?
They have not done any kind of function.
You said the radius was proportional to the length.
Just like,
yeah.
That's not something you could easily explain from any head group geometry.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a spontaneous curvature, then actually this radius of the tube should be equal to the spontaneous radius of curvature, and you pay energy at the cap at the orifice. So in some sense, it should become as long as it can, suck all protein and this membrane.
Right, right. In fact,
and somehow it's...
Yeah. There's more than just the membrane curvature that's playing a role here.
And there's an exchange of lipids with the solution?
No, not really.
I mean, in a sense, are these like constant surface processes?
Yeah. So we mentioned the lipid head and the protein-protein interactions. And the presumption here is really just a packing effect. They haven't quantified, but I think they can really, what's the density on the membrane. I'm wondering, my other surprise is if this is a gel phase, then the curvature preference should be, doesn't want to curl much. So what's I'm a little bit surprised about that.
Can you repeat about the word surprise?
Well, for a gel phase, they're stiffer and they don't want to bend.
No, that's actually going the opposite, not like you said, because if there is a spontaneous curvature, then actually a large bending constant would actually go with this. Mm-hmm. So, but other things, I'm not sure. You want to minimize the bending energy, so.
And then one of the other questions is why is the Fontenot so much different than the POPC? It may be something that we just don't know about in terms of how this is binding. It's not binding, though, to the Fontenot at all. I don't really have an explanation of what that role of the lipid type is in the different tendency to form the tubular structures.
And also, it's not clear why do you form multiple vesicles and multiple tubes? What you drew here is this one vesicle and one tube, right?
Right. Well,
on the previous picture, there were three.
You can do that. And that was kind of back to, I don't know if I.
But it seems that you have a single domain, so why is this?
Well, no, you all have to always have a single domain.
Oh, okay. So these are from different, so it could be coming from different vesicles?
Yes, yeah. Or even a single vesicle could have multiple domains.
We actually minimize the cap, you will get rid of the cap by having. So you go down in energy if you. Because probably the orifice has less penalty than the cap.
What is the aspect ratio of your legs to diameter? So it's a constant, what is it? Equal to what?
I think it's, let's see, I don't know what it was.
But it's somehow.
It's because they can get very long. This distance has gone up to, over 10 microns. And, well, here, 10 microns divided by 50 nanometers. So.
But do they see cap? Do they see cap tubes?
Yeah. So that's basically it, which is kind of a bunch of questions and some things which I think could be more or less directly done. Standard theories, but the likelihood of me doing it has been zero, based on an extrapolation of a year or two of not doing it. So, if anyone's interested in, I can. And you have more questions, I can direct you to the paper and actually to the individual people.
Okay, so I'll tell you about atomistic simulations of lipid binders that we've been doing for a year now. So this talk is quite a bit about technology. I mean, how to actually do these simulations. It's a little bit about showing all how big and fast computers we have. So I want to show the structure of bilans. So I want to talk about the main transition. I think Carlos, you're interested in the main transition. Some electrostatic effects and then hydration interaction between biosurfaces. So I show you simulations on DPPC. That's a DPPC molecule. So there's the phosphate group, which is charged. There is a quaternary nitrogen, which has the opposite charge. So it's strongly sweeter ionic. The glycerol group and these two pi-methyl chains of equal length, which I guess are saturated, right, Carlos?
Let's keep the discussion for after.
Okay, so the way we do this simulation is, so we take a force field that has been developed for the liquid phase, which was optimized to get the correct geometry of the hydrated lipid bilayer. It also has the right, I mean, more or less the right elastic properties, surface tension, surface tension is zero at this simulation, but the bending rigidity they calculated, that was quite okay, and the density is fine, and so on and so forth. So we take this force field, and we don't play with it, we don't question it. And then we start at low temperatures, and we put the lipids in a crystalline tilted state that is known from crystallography. And then we take periodic boundary conditions laterally and also vertically. And in these simulations, we keep the number of water molecules fixed. We can either fix the box, calculate the pressure, or keep the pressure fixed, and then calculate the volume of the system. Okay.
And in practice, how many lipids do you have in your box?
Well, this is now a snapshot. Let's count. I think that's 144.
Okay, 12 by 12.
Something like this, yeah. That's the order. And then a few 10,000 water molecules. And then we can run these simulations for hundreds of nanoseconds. Okay, so we start at low temperatures in the crystalline phase. And then we heat up, typically at constant heating rate. So we increase the temperature in the simulation box at a constant speed, and at some point we end up in a liquid phase. And I will talk about the main transition and how we try to derive the main transition temperature in a bit.
What is the starting temperature?
In this example, it was 310.
And water is at first from ice? Is ice?
What?
310 K.
310.
What's
the kind of temperature? No, what's the temperature? Yeah. So these density autocorrelation functions in plane, so they have been compared to scattering results, to pictures derived from scattering, and they agree very nicely. So that's subject of a paper that is coming out. So the structure seems to be okay as far as we can tell. Now these are, for example, curves now as a function of temperature. So this example, for example, we start at 270, and then we heat up at a constant rate again. So we are not equilibrating. We cannot equilibrate these big systems in simulations. Nobody can. So we can measure all different order parameters. So I think the easiest probably is the area per molecule. That's this gray line here, which shoots up at a certain quite sharply defined temperature. The structure also changes. Now what I want to discuss a little bit is the total system energy. And we can also look at the derivative of the enthalpy as a function of temperature, and that's shown here. So if we are in the crystalline phase, the derivative is small and then it shoots up. If we integrate this peak, this maximum, so then we get the change of enthalpy in the transition, then we get a transition enthalpy of 40 kilojoule per mole, which is very close to experiments. Yeah. Experimentally, for DPPC, it's 35. So this tells us that at least if you look at this experimental thermodynamic measure, we do the right thing. I mean, we somewhat mimic DPPC bilayers. Yeah. So
this is a constant pressure.
This simulation was done at constant pressure.
Mm-hmm. That's dealing with water now. What do you do with reservoir area? Are you doing it at constant area? Or?
Well, this, in fact, we do at constant area, and of course, then you
could. Because that would significantly change
the change, yeah. So
you choose area to match the initial.
Exactly. Then we can do this at different lateral areas, and we see that at least the enthalpy does not depend a lot on the lateral areas you impose.
But can you impose constant
what we could do?
Service tension.
Yeah, this you could do.
Yeah,
you can do
it. For example, there.
So we did this at different, at this point we did these simulations, so this is not published, yeah? So at this point we did this for different constant lateral areas.
And how much it shifts?
Not much. Not I mean you don't see anything on the scale, yeah, given the uncertainties of the simulation.
How can you do constant satisfaction? This changes with temperature.
Oh, no, you can impose boundary
conditions. Technically, you could do it, yeah, but it's exactly what it means.
Yes, you could imagine doing these by take a vesicle, look at the transition as you hold pressure difference.
You apply
pressure and then you keep
functioning. So we could do this.
In principle.
Do you see hysteresis? Have you tried to cool it?
Yes. The point is, if you cool at the rate we can do, we never go back into the crystalline state.
And if you do the heating, do you get the transition more or less at the same point?
No, and that's what I want to discuss now.
Yeah. So if we change the rate, that's what you're asking, right?
I'm thinking about overheating, like how much you are in the...
We always overheat, heat. Yeah.
Do you go to the spindle basically?
No, let's discuss it. Yeah. So I'll discuss it.
So before I discuss the rate dependence of this apparent melting temperature, let me first discuss the dependence on the water chemical potential, or in other words, on the water layer thickness. So experimentally, that's a phase diagram that's from a review by Erich Sackmann. So this is the temperature, that is the water content in percent, and what you see, and that is physiologically...
Can you define what it means? How can
so that's the temperature.
Yeah, let me understand. What does this mean?
That's the water content in percent, and this is 10. 20, 30%.
There are multiple bilayers, and the thickness of water in between has changed.
Yep. So these are bilayer stacks, and what you do is you do phase diagram. The experiments you do, I would guess, at fixed water content, and then you look at the and then you measure the phase coexistence. Now this is a comparison of four different experiments. So let's look at this gray area, and what this gray area means is, this is, in fact, the two-phase coexistence. So you have to look at constant temperature. So this is a two-phase coexistence area between a high water content phase and a low water content phase. So this would be the crystalline low temperature phase. And to the right, this is the high temperature liquid phase, the alpha.
You're talking about water
so
this
is alpha and this is alpha.
These are water bands between the layers, you mean?
Of course, yeah.
And
some waters also inside it, but that's how you do the measurement.
It's global water content. The phase is lipid rich, it's almost only lipid, and then you put a few percent of water.
Can the potential the same change in
water?
It's a bio
water. I mean, this also is
okay, maybe.
No, I mean, how many water layers between the stacks this correspond to? I mean, this number.
How many water molecules?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So the actual water content per lipid, this varies. I mean, in this range, you have between, let's say, I would say 6 water molecules per lipid head and 20. So that's the typical range you're looking at here. So when I say water, okay. Maybe a drug picture.
Okay.
So the way you do the...
It's a thickness of water layer between...
These lipids are about 700 in molecular weight, so take 20% of that, divide by the water weight, and that's it.
Okay. Yeah. So that's how let's say if you could look into this phase, you would have these lipid bilayers that are separated by very small water slabs. Again, 20 weight percent. It means you have a very small water layer.
This is like 1 or 2 nanometers.
Or
1 or 2 nanometers.
Yeah. And then what you do in these experiments, you simply look at the phase separation. Okay. You simply map out this. I mean, it's like when you do a phase diagram. If you map out a water phase diagram, temperature and water content. These are your control parameters.
So it saturates around 20 molecules, big water molecules.
Where are the two phases here?
liquids. What do you mean by saturates?
Well, I mean, you have this behavior.
The atoms are crystalline.
But this would be a saturation. I mean, you would call, So this would be, and at some point, of course, you will hit at some point.
This is the water layer, how many molecules between the
And at some point, So what you see is if you really go to excess water, so if you add basically 80% of water, then you would have a macroscopic phase separation of a water-rich phase, which would be micella and L1 phase, and then you would have the binding. So in this case, the DPPC, they stay together, they're bound.
So on the picture, where is the water region? I try to understand what you mean by. So is this separation, was it a plane or?
So this would be the lipid bilayer.
Right.
The two lipids, they have two chains, they face towards the wall, and the water's in the green.
Uh-huh. And so what are two phases you're talking about?
Two possible thickness.
So again, so that's the alpha, the high temperature phase, and that's the beta phase, which is the low temperature phase.
Is, is that because of melting of the bilayer?
You know what the alpha is. No? You don't know the name?
I think I've seen, I don't know the number.
Okay, so let's go back to picture, maybe that's... So the alpha, you call this? Yeah, the alpha phase where the chains are disordered, where you have many gauche defects. This you call the beta phase, where basically the chains are frozen. If it's tilted, you put a prime on it, and it's typically always frozen. Now the transition, because you freeze out all these degrees of freedom, this transition is characterized by huge entropy change. Because you change, of course, the orientation degrees of freedom available to the chains, and it's really driven mostly by the chains, by the freezing of the chain degrees of freedom.
The conformation is typical of rotator phase, something like that.
Again?
Mm-hmm. It's a rotator type of phase conformation of alkanes, something like that.
Yeah.
Analogous to that.
And if you decrease the water content, do you drive the transition to?
Well, that's what I was. That's the phase, right?
Yeah, so which one is
that? So I repeat. Temperature, low temperature, high temperature, that's the water content. So this is zero water, so then it's you don't have any water. And as you increase the water content, you see that this temperature goes down. Yeah. So there's also phase coexistence at equal temperature. Yeah, so you can draw tie lines in here. And don't get confused by these four different areas. So let's look at the gray line. That's one experiment. So that was a review by Sakma. Okay?
Then let's just add a comment. If you talk to any experimentalist that work on lipids and ask him what is the temperature transition, the main temperature transition for the DPPC, he's going to tell you 42 degrees. And that's because most of the experiments are done to the right of that. Yeah. So this is about understanding what happens when you do the transition with less water in your system. Yeah. So that's.
And then. What we did is basically we tried to recover this effect, because if we decrease the water content and we get the right trend in this main transition temperature, then we would believe that we somewhat capture the water lipid interaction correctly. And so it was a very crucial test.
So you can basically say that the water plasticizes the lipids, right?
The water
plasticizes the lipids. If you add water, you make it more liquid. The lipid phase. Just by looking at the high looks like.
And in your simulations, do you have the two phases? Is one layer is one phase and another phase? Or is it each phase?
In the simulation. So that's basically my simulation box. So that is the simulation box. Okay? So we simulate one bilayer with periodic boundary conditions laterally. So it has no edges, infinite extent laterally. And periodic boundary conditions also vertically. We would love to simulate two bilayers, even maybe three in 5 years. And we will do two bilayers. I'm now buying new computers. But the atomistic simulation I show you, these are the first simulations, atomistic simulations with explicit water on the main transition. Yeah? So these things are not so easy. Yeah? I mean, simply they take a long time.
Can you look at this kind of fluctuation?
Or everything, sure. The protrusion we did,
Okay.
Yes, yeah? Okay, so let's first do a few checks that we know that the simulations capture that they describe real bilayers, and then I'll talk a little bit about mechanisms.
Yeah. So one crucial test again was this temperature dependence. And
now I show a plot where I plot the main transition temperature, and again that's the temperature at which I see a this jump in the enthalpy, or alternatively where I see a peak in the capacity. Yeah, so I plot this temperature as a function of the heating rate with which I heat up my simulation box starting from low temperatures, and I do this for three different water contents. So this is lots of water for us, 31 water molecules per lipid head, 10 and 7. And the main thing what you see is that indeed, as and of course in the simulations I heat the system at a constant rate, and that's probably the cleanest way to show the data. Yeah, because when people do simulations at one temperature and then they tell you it's equilibrated, it simply means they stopped the simulation. Yeah. Either because the PhD student had to write up, or they ran out of grant money, blah, blah, blah. So this as a function of heating rate. And what you see is that indeed the main transition temperature goes down as you add more water. And if you, let's go back to the phase diagram. And if you look at the temperature for a given heating rate, if you look at the temperature difference, that comes out okay. And only for a given heating rate.
For the equilibrium, you extrapolate to zero.
Oh, right? We try. We always try to extrapolate. So that's not so easy.
Now, how would you do such an extrapolation? Yeah. So, and that's really the simplest way of doing this. So, if you assume you are at low temperatures, this would then be the crystalline state, this would be the fluid state, you have to hop over some barrier. And if you simply make a rate model based on a two-state process, you go from here to there, and you put in that you change the temperature at constant rate, and then you calculate, for example, the flux from the low temperature state to the high temperature state. And you ask yourself, okay, what is the temperature at which you get the highest flux over the barrier? And so this would be basically in the simulation the temperature at which you see a maximum in the heat capacity. So if you do this, you can solve it numerically. The equations, the differential equation, has no unfortunately has no analytic solution because of this time dependence of the temperature.
Yeah. Where's the third state? You know, the three state.
Yeah, forget the third state, two states. Yeah. So if you make an irreversible approximation, so if you assume you only go from the frozen state to the liquid state, you don't cross back, which is okay because we never see it in simulations. Yeah? So then in fact you can either solve it analytically, and what you get, and that's not surprising, is that the change of the apparent transition temperature with the log of the heating rate, that should be proportional, yes. So the apparent melting temperature should depend linearly on the log of the heating rate. It's very similar when you, for example, stretch a biomolecule and you change to force as a function of time. Now, this we see quite nicely. Yeah, so again, if we take...
But you don't know the barrier, right? Or
we know a little. We can, by fitting, we can learn a little bit about the barrier. Now, so it means that all these data, in fact, they in a Lin log plot, they fall quite nicely on straight lines. So by fitting the slope, which is a temperature, we can then in fact estimate the enthalpy of the barrier. That's the usual thing. Now, we don't get the entropy of the barrier. That's in the prefactor, but we get the enthalpy. The enthalpy, interestingly, turns out to be 1 kilojoule per mole, quite small, very small, as compared to the full enthalpy that you invest in order to cross this transition. 1 kilojoule per mole versus 40. That's interesting. So what it basically tells you is that the transition state is characterized by a state where you don't lose so much enthalpy. Okay. Yeah, but we don't get the entropy, and that's the bad thing. what you expect for in the limit of zero heating rate, we would expect this, of course, to somewhat saturate. And from the saturation, okay, you would then, of course, extract the true melting temperature. This we don't see. We don't get, go to this limit. And even corrections to this linear law, we don't get. Even from a correction, we would be able to extract the zero rate melting temperature. We don't see that here. But what we can say is that indeed the this model, I mean, it allows to draw a few conclusions, and one conclusion is
quite apart from your data, I don't see how in your equation this limit of zero heating rate.
No, sure. I mean, in order to get this saturation, you then of course you have to solve the model also allowing expansions. And then if you go to the stationary state,
you didn't allow that.
Well, I mean, not here, but of course we numerically we solved it.
Very experimental point is not very far from where you are, so there isn't much of a, but you have a huge room in heating rate and almost no room in along the temperature, so something has to break right away.
It's still 4 degrees down or 6?
Well, look,
it should be 42, so that's
sure. It would be let's put it this way. The force field, again, has been developed in the fluid phase, okay? It has not been optimized for the crystalline state. If, let's say, if we could go to 100 times slower heating, which we cannot, and we will not be able to do this within the next 10, 20 years, yeah? If we could, let's say, and we would see the saturation, there's no reason to believe that the true transition temperature would match the experimental one, yeah? I think what one should be a little bit more careful just look at differences. So I would be more confident in comparing the apparent temperatures at a given heating rate. And from the analytic model, we have some belief that indeed that the difference in the apparent melting temperature does not depend so much on the heating rate. Yeah, so it's a subfluent correction. So that's why I would say, so we can believe in these differences, I would not believe in the actual temperature.
I mean, for these three numbers, I mean, the red, the blue, and black, I mean, how should we envision the relative separation between neighboring layers? So how do they compare to the thickness of the layers themselves?
Much, much smaller.
Which layer? Which layer?
Well, I have the bilayer.
Hmm?
And now I have also the water layer, okay, just the pictorial.
Yeah. So that's a picture.
And so now,
that's like a picture. That's a simulation.
Well, but this is a sort of one to one, basically. So I see that the layer of the thickness of the water layer is like the thickness of the bilayer.
That's the largest water content we did.
So that's
and, and at the lowest water content, four water molecules per lipid head, then that layer would roughly have this thickness here.
Oh, I see. So actually, okay. But then the important thing, do you know this stuff that we did with Kachenko many years ago about the surface freezing?
Of what?
The mechanism of surface freezing in alkanes.
Yeah, of alkanes.
So this is kind of essentially the monolayer is stabilized by fluctuations of that type.
Mm-hmm.
It's the entropy that stabilizes the sort of crystallization. And it may be like that because you are actually having very small separation between the layers, and so fluctuations in neighboring layers are suppressed. While if you have more water,
no, we never see protrusion fluctuations, even if we add excess water. So it doesn't happen apparently. The reason probably is that these Switagarnik heads, they have a strong interaction with each other. So they probably lock in. They have some preferential relative position, I would say.
Yeah.
And if you simply look at these pictures,
are you talking about the gel phase or the liquid phase?
Well, I mean the hydration we did in the gel phase, but even there if we estimate
the
contribution of the lipid interactions to the total pressure between two bilayers, it's extremely small, and interestingly, it is always it's small. Okay, so what's the time?
27.
Speak for how many more minutes? Okay, well. So that was a little bit. You see, but this problem of that you don't reach equilibrium, that is universal. Yeah, I don't know of any simulation on a non-trivial problem where you reach equilibrium. Yeah, so you always have to find a way of somewhat extrapolating or looking at differences, blah blah blah. Yeah, so it's very universal. That's not because I'm stupid because the computers in Germany are slow. That's how it is, yeah?
Roland, but in the case of bilayers, for example, in the liquid phase, what's the diffusion time for a liquid to exchange with
another liquid? It's not a good number to look at. You don't see flip flops, you don't see side exchanges, forget it.
Yeah.
Simply, it's, don't even think about asking this question.
No, it's really beyond. Yeah?
Okay, then what's the time scale where this is? Is it like milliseconds? Like there must be some time scale, right?
Yeah. No, microseconds.
Microseconds?
The lateral diffusion, yeah, that's microseconds.
But the whole membrane, what's the time scale for its equilibration?
Yeah, microseconds.
Well, I mean, microseconds are not accessible.
No, I mean, the time scale for the whole membrane, that doesn't exist. It scales, of course, the time scale increases with the size you're looking at. You know?
But that means in nature, so yeah.
Nature.
It's also a good question, but I would say there are experiments where you do equilibrate, of course, on the scale at which you look at. Yeah, but not in the simulations. You don't even have side exchange laterally.
Why are you saying that?
If you have a diffusional process and you look at diffusion over large length scales, that equilibrates very slowly.
But, I mean, it's solid. It's a piece of solid equilibrium in that regard. I mean, also we don't look on time scales there.
You tell me.
Okay.
Because you make a dent in it and it doesn't
okay.
So
let me call. Yeah. All I'm saying is these. You know, I'm doing atomistic simulations since 6 years, and I'm learning every day.
Can you tell us why did you start to do it?
No, I really got interested. I'm still interested in them. I still have lots of fun, I would say. I mean, there are certain questions you can and you should ask to an atomistically resolved simulations, and there are certain questions you simply don't ask. That's it.
You have to make this final.
If you look at mechanical properties like in plane shear or things like that, you can still access and understand.
I mean, this would be like viscosities. No, we didn't.
High frequency.
Yeah.
No, zero shear.
Okay, but one thing we did. That is this hydration pressure, the interaction now between, in principle, two bilayers. So in the simulations we do, and mind you, we only have one bilayer. So it is an interaction between one bilayer with its image. Okay. And so the pressure, of course, there are many contributions. So electrostatics, we all were really interested in electrostatics many years ago. There's one contribution, Van der Waals interaction, undulation repulsion, both into bending modes and surface tension modes. And so what we tried to extract from these simulations, what we did is the hydration interaction. That's the interaction, the repulsion between hydrated bilayers at very small separation.
But you're just compressing it with a single barrier with a pressure. Not
well,
barrier.
If we want to get the pressure out, then of course we have to do it differently. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise we would simply measure what we put in. Sure, of course not. Now, just that's a measurement by one of many measurements pioneered by Adrian. And what you see is that's a logarithmic scale, that's angstrom, that's the thickness of the water layer, which he extracts from the simulation, from his measurements. And what you see very universally is this exponential decay of the pressure. Okay, and this you see between all types of biosurfaces, biopolymers, bioparticles.
What is the axis?
That's the thickness of the water layer in between two bilayers. So he knows the water content, he knows the repeat distance, and from that he can then extract the thickness of the water layer. Yeah, so this is at separations of 2 nanometers. And that's a separation that we have in simulation. So in principle, we should be able to get this out somewhere.
Wait, where is the artificial pressure?
The artificial pressure is basically in the next room over there.
Okay. So this is the beta?
That's alpha.
Alpha.
The L would even be in the beta, it would be still in the hallway. So you see, I'm exaggerating. I mean, you see here a change. I mean, that's where other effects come in. Yeah, but this is this is really the Helfrich repulsion method.
You can also monitor what happens to the water molecules.
But I think
and if there is no trivial
exactly layers, and that's the main reason for doing this, right? Because now we can zoom in and test some of the classical theory.
You may not have enough skill for the entries.
No, we don't. We for sure do not have the right scale for getting the any type of hedgehog repulsion. But also, mind you, Ronnie, if you have a finite tension and you have bending rigidity, at the shortest distances, you don't see the hedgehog repulsion, which decays like 1 over distance cubed. You first see the repulsion of the surface tension modes, which also decay exponentially. But if you look at the free factor, I really didn't want to talk about this, but since you trigger me, so that would be the Helfrich free energy, and this is the prediction from nonlinear randomization group theory that people have developed in Wetting. That would be the prediction for the tangent-dominated or tangent-induced fluctuation repulsion, which also goes logarithmic, exponential, but the length scale here, if you put in numbers, that is in fact much larger. And it turns out to be in the nanometer scale. Yeah, so it's a different decay length. Yeah? And absolutely, we would not see it in the simulation simply because we don't have these modes. Absolutely. So it's one of these questions you should not ask to these simulations. Yeah. And if you are interested in these, then you do different simulations. And this I did in fact in my PhD. And then you do a coarse grain.
Can you explain your simulation again? What boundary condition you're imposing? Because I'm still confused. What you're measuring?
So we have periodic boundary conditions, and then before I talked about constant pressure, and now I will talk about something else.
Yeah, so what you're talking about now?
I will talk about something else.
that's
experiments, Michael.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Now, so let me skip a few things. Now, when people try to get these interactions between layers with hydrophilic groups in water, so there were two approaches traditionally. The main obstacle is you have to keep the water chemical potential constant, right? Because as you squeeze these layers, the water can freely equilibrate because you want to measure the pressure. So you don't want to enforce the pressure, you want to enforce the constant chemical potential. And there have been two routes, two methods. And one was first used by Bernie and now lately by Max. And what they do is they take small plates with some groups, and they can also put lipid-N groups on these plates. And then they immerse everything in a big water box, and this water box is kept at atmospheric pressures. Then you allow the water to move from the space between these plates to move out into this reservoir. It takes a long time, and at the end you can measure the force on these plates.
So you're putting some potential, soft potential on the plates to apply a force on them.
I think how Max usually does, I mean, again, I don't do this, but what Max Berkowitz, what he does is he holds them at a certain position and he measures the force.
Okay,
yeah. But it's not soft, typically you freeze them. You can also put a soft potential. But that's the detail, it's not so important. But the main problem here is long diffusion time, long relaxation time for the water to move in and out, small plates, and therefore edge effects, which are difficult to estimate.
And did they get an exponential decay too?
Why is there an edge effect?
Because when you have finite size plates, you know, like my hands, you know, then, and let's say, you know, they can have a separation of a width of a few, 1-2 nanometers, not more.
Right.
Because you need a big water box.
Sure.
So then if you go to a separation that is of the order of the diameter of your plates, you expect edge effect, finite size effect, because you have finite size plates. You can only go to a certain distance.
The pressure.
If I take my two hands and I look at the separation, then you don't have the interaction between two planar objects. You have the interaction between two point-like objects.
No, I understand all of that. I'm just trying to see if I put it very close, why is the current so slow? Because you don't need to diffuse all the distance.
But this. In this range, this is between 1 and 2 nanometers. That is not very close. Yeah? So you have quite a few layers of water in between. Yeah?
But still, what do I
mean? So Max can do his simulations basically up here. He cannot go to this regime. Yeah? And plus, because of this binding to a plate, you don't really know, for example, whether you have the protrusion modes correctly in there. Yeah?
But again, what is the problem with simulation? Because you're saying it takes too long to do what?
it takes quite some time for the water
to diffuse out from, let's say you fix your plates at a certain separation, then the water is not equilibrated. Let's say it is pressurized.
Right.
Then it has to move out.
But it can also move out around the edges because of the density wave. You can just distribute it inside. You don't have to diffuse all the way around.
No, it has to diffuse out, and again, that's, all these nanoseconds, they keep doing simulations. Yeah.
In any case, look,
it's a sound wave relaxation. It's not really a
rotation of diffusion.
It's not, I mean, honestly, at these scales, you don't have propagative sound waves. It's mostly shear waves. It's viscosity dominated effects. It's not sound waves. if this thing would spill out with ultrasonic speed, we would be fine. But, Michael,
this is all somewhat details. The main point is there was no simulation that could compare with these data, for whatever reasons. Yeah.
And if Max was here, he could explain to us why.
Well, because there's a lot of water outside as well, that's the problem.
Sure. So then, in the second way of dealing with a constant water chemical potential is doing it grand canonically. And that's been done by Perlstein and Grunz and also other people. So what you do here is, you do a simulation, you don't fix stimulation box, you don't fix the number of water molecules, but you allow water molecules to come in and out, and you do this via Gibbs insertion. Now the problem is, when you do these simulations, what you typically do is you try to put a water molecule in with a random orientation, or you can also do some umbrella pre-biasing, but you try to put it in at spaces. If you do these simulations with lipid bilayers with lots of water, the chance of putting a water molecule in and it's staying there is so small that you waste so much time on trying to insert water, trying to stick it in, it never happens. So again, these simulations could never reach the pressure resolution order to compare with experimental data. Okay, so what we do is, and that's somewhat trivial, so what we do is, and now I come to the boundary conditions, the ensemble. What we do is, so we do a simulation at fixed volume, and we first fix the number of water molecules. So it's a fixed N, fixed V simulation. And clearly the chemical potential of the water will not be correct, right? So we have a target chemical potential, which would be the mu zero. That would be the water, the chemical potential of bulk water at a certain temperature. What we can do is we can determine the chemical potential of the water in our simulation, and we know the error we make, and then we use thermodynamics. And if you use a few Maxwell relations and do a few calculations, then you see that there is an expression which is very simple for the correction to the pressure. So indeed, the pressure at the correct chemical potential would be the one at the same separation D, at the chemical potential you actually do have in your simulation, minus a correction term. And this correction term has a very simple shape. It's just the difference in chemical potential divided by something that boils down to the volume of a water molecule in that specific simulation environment. Now, this is approximate, so there are correction terms, and also this is expand, but we can check this. And what we do, let me just finish the story because it's simple. So we can check this thermodynamic relation. So here I plot the difference in chemical potential and the difference in the pressure you actually measure. And indeed, for all different simulations, for all different particle numbers, this lies very nicely in a straight line, which tells us the only thing we need is the slope of that line, which is just the volume of a water molecule. And then we can very easily extract pressures at any chemical potential we want. And of course, also, we can use a similar expression for very quickly determining the number of water molecules we need in our simulation box to have the correct chemical potential. So we can, again, do, let's say, a very efficient simulation and get with two quite short simulations, we can get, in fact, the correct water molecule number we need to have a constant chemical potential. Yeah.
And how do you measure chemical potential?
That we would do by insertion, or by extraction. So there are different ways. Or we can do thermodynamic integrations. We typically use two different methods and then we compare.
So you do these insertions and then short runs?
Well, it's more complicated. What you do is, in fact, you do first a thermodynamic integration. Felix, you know this better. You guys, didn't you?
For the water, typically, you have a Levin-Jones interaction and electrostatics. So for the Levin-Jones, you do an insertion because it works quite well. And then for the electrostatics, you do a thermodynamic integration. You because there again, if you would do insertions, you have the same problem as in the grand command simulation.
Right, so what do you mean if you still have the insertion, why don't you look at
it? Well, we don't need insertion only as an analytic tool to know the wrong chemical potential. Then we can calculate the pressure, and number two, we can calculate the number of water molecules that we need to put in. We put those in, and then we can again compare and we see it's self-consistent. Okay, I mean, Michael, you're not an MD simulation guy. You're more impressed by data. Let me basically zoom into the results, because you know the main reason why we do this is because now we can calculate the pressure between DPTC bias and compare with experiment. Yeah? And that's basically the explanation why we do this. We do this because now we can compare simulation data with experiments. Okay? And so if we do this for DPPC, so that's the pressure in Pascal versus the separation. These are the red data is our simulations. The blue it's the classical experimental results by Adrian. And then you see that without basically playing, the numbers compare quite nicely. There are deviations, small separations. And we have reason to believe that that's okay to have deviation there, but there's basically quite good agreement at the intermediate distance scale where we expect the long-range hydration pressure to work.
This is at room temperature.
That is room temperature.
And the other simulations agree with yours or with precision?
The other simulations, they are somewhat...
Well, they're both the same thing.
Same here. Now the DPPC, you know, when Max tries to simulate DPPC because he puts them on a lattice, it's different. I mean, he never compares. Yeah, that's the point. The other people. Okay, fine. So let me basically, so this was all just explaining the technology. So that's the technology now one can use to calculate the pressures, interactions between complex surfaces at constant water chemical potential. Why would you care? Okay, so this comparison shows you that probably we do something correct, and now I think it becomes interesting for theorists, because now we can look into the simulation and try to understand what is this repulsion. Yeah. And since I've talked already for some time, I want to basically cut it a little bit short. So what we can do now is we can separate the pressure into entropic and enthalpic contributions. We can do more. We can, if we have a certain interaction energy, we can ask how much of this is due to water-water, water-membrane, membrane-membrane interactions, and so on and so forth. So we can really dissect and decompose interaction energies and then look at all the different contributions and try to make sense. So let me first show you one picture. And this picture we can look at here. This is in fact the water density profile between the two bilayers at different water content. Okay, this is blue, 28 water molecules per liquid head, 14, and green is 10. And what you see is that if you have more water than 14 water molecules per liquid head, there is a bulk-like region where in fact the water density is constant and it corresponds exactly to the bulk water density. Yeah, so this is this line here. This also parallel, if we for example look at the water, if we look at the water enthalpy profile, if you have more than 14 water molecules per lipid head, in fact, the water enthalpy, the local water enthalpy as a function of the position, is constant, corresponds to bulk. And only if you squeeze more and more water out, then in fact, you start to squeeze out, to pull out interfacially strongly bound water molecules. So this suggests immediately that this 14 water molecules per lipid head is like a dividing line at larger separation. You don't pull out. If you push them together, you don't basically extract interfacial water. You rather pull out the water in the bulk, which is loosely bound. And then you would expect some more or less long-range type of interaction to govern the hydration repulsion. If you go to smaller separations, you more and more deplete interfacial water, and then more energetic effects come into play.
So at which separation in these terms, the experimental results in the simulation we made?
So let me see.
But this is similar to surface force measurement, but they usually see about oscillations.
No. Adrian never sees oscillations. You see oscillations when you put them on a solid substrate, and this we also see. Yeah. I mean, if we skip this, but there are different ways. I mean, if we, for example, take rigid layers by freezing the interior carbon atoms, and we calculate the pressure here, then indeed
see oscillations. This would be the pressure we simulate between these rigid layers, and then you see oscillations.
Now you see
if you smear them out, we can in fact convolute over the shape of the surface, and we get the profile that you would get for soft interfaces. So it's a simply convolution, quite simple in that.
So let me somewhat finish this. So there are these two different regimes, and the easiest way to see these two different regimes is by looking, for example, at the energy entropy decomposition that's shown here.
So what I show here is the free energy, the Gibbs free energy of the whole system as a function of the water content per lipid. So this is always repulsive. This we can, in the simulation, separate easily into the entropy and the enthalpy by simply calculating the enthalpy, the expectation value of the Hamiltonian we put in. And then what you see is that the entropy, the minus Ts, this guy here, is repulsive at large separations. The energy, in fact, is attractive. And this picture changes more or less at these 14 lipid, at these 14 water molecules per lipid, where in fact then the energy becomes repulsive, slope negative, and the entropy more or less levels off. So what you see in the water density, water energy profiles, it's also thermodynamically, you get it out if you look at the free energy of interaction.
So you would say you have kind of oval-like structure?
What we would say is this energy, this energetic repulsion, this you can easily get by doing a calculation where you assume that you extract bound water from the interfaces. You simply, it's basically an ideal gas type of theory. Yeah? So you assume that your water molecules sit in some potential, and then you remove them one by one. And of course, you remove them right in the middle. Then you can calculate the pressure, and you get an enthalpically dominated pressure.
How many kg per water molecules?
Oh, kg per mole, you got divided by what,
1.8? You're counting per layer or something?
This is a kilojoule per mole. And there's a you multiply or you divide by 2.5. This is even per lipid, sorry.
That's what I'm asking. I'm asking per water per mole, because somehow you're counting.
This is per water molecule, sorry. Because that is the bulk enthalpy of water in bulk at atmospheric pressure. It's per water molecule. So that means you multiply or divide by 2.5. Or you do both.
And then you have error bars on the H plot on the left?
Our simulations are perfect.
The issue I think is that this energy entropy decomposition is that sometimes the energy fluctuations are so huge that you could
not want to know them. It's again one of the wrong questions. absolutely. I mean the energy it fluctuates widely because that scales. Right. I mean the error scales right. with the total number of molecules in your box, whereas the pressure does not scale. Does not have But you know what we do is we spent most of simulation time in this project on getting the energy. And so we did microsecond simulations.
Right. I think a more maybe reliable way to extract this decomposition, if you could do multiple temperatures and differentiate free energy.
We did it also, right? But that didn't work so well.
But when you calculate energy of water, isn't there like a gradient of energy as you move from the surface? I mean, different water molecules have different energy. You just start averaging over everything.
No. This is a position resolved energy profile. Yeah. So what you do is there are different ways of doing this. You follow a water molecule, you measure its energy of interaction with water molecules and with lipid molecules, and then you do a resolved. You bin it in boxes according to its separation from the lipids. Now this is resolved. It is per water molecule. Okay. Let me
somewhat. So there's this. So for short separations, there's an enthalpically dominated repulsion because you pull out hydration water from the basically head region, and for large separations, you have an enthalpically dominated regime. And let me explain this. I mean, I explained this a week ago a little bit. So and that's this Marsella picture. So what Marsella assumed was that you have some free energy functional, some order parameter eta squared plus gradient
eta squared, where eta he believed to be something like a polarization in z direction. Now, if you impose boundary conditions on this eta on a parameter and you say it's on one surface it's plus, on the other it's negative, you calculate the optimal order parameter profile, which turns out to be a cinch. You calculate the pressure from this. This pressure turns out to be an exponentially decaying profile. Now the point is, if you believe that this eta has anything to do with dipole orientation, then you know immediately that this whole Hamiltonian here has to be proportional to epsilon to the minus one. Yeah, because all electrostatic interactions, they scale like dielectric constant inverse. Epsilon to the minus one, however, is proportional to temperature, and that tells you immediately that this whole thing is entropic, mostly, with a very small enthalpy contribution. That's like electrostatic interaction, they're always entropic. Yeah? It's in fact not even one. If you take the derivative of the epsilon to the inverse dielectric constant with respect to temperature, at room temperature it's 1.3, it's even more entropic. Yeah? So, and that means, let me just finish because then we are done. So that means that believing this Masseria picture, you immediately conclude that it must be an entropic repulsion with a small enthalpic attractive component, in fact, yeah, because of this 1.36. Now what we do is, in order to nail this down a little bit, we, in the simulations, we extract the dipolar order parameter profile. So we simply measure the PZ, the Z component of the water dipole moment, and that's shown here at different, again, water contents, 16 water, 20, 28 water per lipid. These are the red, yellow, and the blue lines. And we can even fit to some degree, we can even produce a fit of these dipolar profiles with the prediction from Masseria's model, yeah, with a cinch profile. Again, this doesn't prove that this is a mechanism, because there could be different competing mechanisms like structural order parameter profile, blah, blah, blah. But you know, at this point, I'm happy to stop and say we confirm this Masseria picture, of course, in conjunction with the fact that it's mostly entropic. So this basically concludes. So we can do now these simulations. So we are very proud and happy. So we showed that in the hydration interaction between lipid bilayers, there are these two different regimes. One is entropically dominated, one enthalpically. And of course, the question is what to do next. So there are a few things we could think of. And then now I'm basically asking for your advice and comments. So Carlos told me he's interested in the main transition as a function of the position of double bonds. So that's something we could easily do. I think that's doable. With all, of course, the caveats that we are, we never see the main transition, we only see rate dependent shifts, but you know, I think that's the best thing you can do at the moment. Okay, thank you.
Do we stop here or do we still have 10 minutes? One movie?
Sure.
Okay, can I have the cable? The cable?
The video projector.
We should always say hello to mom and so on because we are all there, right? Hey, you. Like in the TV shows. Okay, let's see if we can put this on here. Perhaps the first thing I should show you, as a matter of fact, is the person who did the job I'm going to tell about. He'll be up for a postdoc in about 1 year and a half, and if you are an experimental guy, you might be interested in start writing to him. He's extremely good. And if you get him, you also get skills on, let's see, where is this guy? At traditional Alsace dance, you know, with the hat and so on. He's quite resilient too, you know, he can undergo through these, here is George.
Where is the movie?
These are just pictures. Look, they can get into these positions and still survive. So I don't know. He's a good hire for sure. Georges Weber. So what Georges did? We have been interested in this thing called photodynamical therapy. Not on the therapy itself, but on the molecular basis for it. So what this thing is used for is to destroy tissue locally. You apply locally a little bit of a cream or something with molecules that are photosensitizers. These photosensitizers generate radical species, usually singlet oxygen, and that oxidizes